New York City is the source of some of the nation's most expensive real estate and construction sagas, the Brooklyn Bridge, the Empire State Building, and the current emotional debate over the World Trade Center site. A new book by Daniel Okrent puts Rockefeller Center squarely in that pantheon. It's a story filled with vivid personalities, tremendous accomplishment, and simply astonishing amounts of money. It's called Great Fortune, the Epic of Rockefeller Center. If you've visited Rockefeller Center or ever worked there, call and tell us about your experiences with this monumental project. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN@npr.org. And Danny Okrent joins us now from our bureau in New York, 7 blocks south and 3 blocks east of Rockefeller Center. Thanks and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
How are you, Neil? Nice to talk to you.
I'm good. How are you?
Great.
It started out as a project to house the Metropolitan Opera and ended up switching mediums to become the hub of the radio industry. How did this happen?
Well, it was a terrible mistake that John D. Rockefeller Jr. made in 1928 when he listened to the people who were controlling the Metropolitan Opera House, and they said, if you would acquire this piece of land for us in Midtown Manhattan, we'll build an opera house there. Well, he said he would do that, and he signed a long-term lease with Columbia University, which owned the land, and then the stock market crashed. And when the stock market crashed, the rich guys who owned the Metropolitan Opera said, excuse me, would you build the house too? And he said, get out of here. And he was stuck with 11 acres of Midtown and had to do something with it.
And what he did was truly remarkable. Let's talk for a minute, though, about John D. Rockefeller Jr., universally, I guess, known as Junior. There's a great line from Mark Twain about him. He described him as an earnest, sincere, honest, well-meaning, commonplace person, destitute of any originality or any suggestion of it. Now, how did a man
what he was not destitute of was his name and his fortune. He was the son of the great John D. Rockefeller Sr., the oil baron who became the richest man in the world and who overpowered his son in every way. The son bore the name on his shoulders, but really couldn't bear business. And he had one business adventure early in his career and then stopped and became a philanthropist. He was the Rockefeller who started to give away the money. And then about 20 years later, in 1930, he does his only other business adventure, and it turns out to be Rockefeller Center.
And you mentioned at the beginning there was this meeting where they called together the group of people who they were hoping would help finance this project or be involved with it. And it was people who, as I think the list was made up of people who had $10 million or more, which was a lot of money before the Depression. But you write that as rich as all of these, Astors and Vanderbilts and Harrimans were, John D. Rockefeller Jr. was in a class by himself.
He gave away over $500 million from 1915 to 1930 when a dollar was worth $14 today. So figure that out, $7 billion that he gave away. It was really the first great American philanthropy. That family created the idea of the American plutocratic class giving away their money for good purposes.
Now, as you mentioned, when Mr. Rockefeller found himself stuck with this 11 acres of land, now he was a guy widely known as a teetotaler, and when he acquired the rather tawdry area underneath the old 6th Avenue elevated train, suddenly he found himself the landlord of 1,000 speakeasies.
Yeah, it was the part of Manhattan that had not been developed during the 20s because Columbia University had owned it and didn't really care about it. It was a bunch of brownstones that had turned into flop houses and brothels and speakeasies. And worse, John D. Rockefeller Jr. lived 3 blocks north on 54th Street, and this wasn't a very pleasant neighbor to have. So he had another motivation besides his enormous investment in the land to turn this place around and to get rid of those things which were such a plight and a pox to him.
If you'd like to join our conversation about Rockefeller Center, again, the phone number is 800-989-8255, and the email address is TOTN@npr.org. Let's talk with Yvonne, who's with us in Portland, Oregon.
Yes, during World War II, I had a job for a big company at 30 Rock. And as a messenger, I discovered all the underground layers that many people don't realize exist there. You could go from building to building, block to block, underground, and there were 3 or 4 different underground layers below the main floor, all with shops, shoeshine parlors, dry cleaners, you name it. It was really quite an adventure to go and discover all these underground places that many people never discovered. Only the people who really worked there and took the time to go and run errands all over the place. You didn't even have to go outside for the day to eat or to run your errands, have things dry cleaned or whatever.
Daniel Oakrant, that was a fundamental part of the design.
It was absolutely part of it. It was had never been done before. It's been imitated all over the world. There are any number of cities that have underground shopping concourses. What's interesting is that Rockefeller Center never made a penny. It was always a loser. Below those three levels of shops is another level that even people who work there don't know about. One of the great things about Rockefeller Center, Neil, is that when you're standing in the middle of it in 49th Street, 50th Street, there are no trucks parked on the street, and that's because 60 feet below street level, there's a 400 by 400-foot room is where all the trucks go. They go down a ramp, and they unload everything they have for everybody who works in all of those buildings, and they never clutter up the street.
Yvonne, it must have been a magnificent place to work all those years ago.
It was a lot of fun, and even now they still close, I believe, one of the streets once a year, don't they?
Well, in fact, they've now closed that permanently. The new owners of Rockefeller Center decided to stop with the ritual and just put up some bars to keep people from walking through.
It was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call.
Bye.
One of the amazing things, to talk for a minute about the architect of Rockefeller Center who gave it that Art Deco look, Ray Hood, there's a great story you tell about him. As he would approach an intersection when he was driving, what did he do, Dan?
He would speed up because he said, this is the quickest way to get through an intersection is to go faster. So he would have accidents on a regular basis and think it was the most normal thing in the world. He was the least likely partner for John D. Rockefeller Jr. Hood was a drinker, he was a joker, he was a party guy, and he was a truly, truly great architect who made this fantastic piece of modern design in the heart of Manhattan.
Now, architecturally, Rockefeller Center did break some new ground. At the time, though, when the design first came out, nobody seemed to like it.
Lewis Mumford, who was probably the most important architectural critic of the time, said that it was bad with a juvenile badness, and he said that if this is what architects do with their freedom, they should be kept in chains. Mumford attacked the buildings over and over and over. As each new one opened up, he would come up with another imprecation, and then finally, when it was all done, he said it was great and never admitted that he had not liked it in the beginning. Tells you about critics, I think.
It tells you a little bit about critics. Now, one of the most impressive things about the Rockefeller Center, I think everybody who's been there certainly remembers the statue of Prometheus, and there's the Atlas holding up the world. Numbers of monumental works of art for the center. The one that has truly passed into legend, though, is the one that never made it to the display. Tell us about the Night of the Murdered Mural.
Well, that was the famous fresco created by the Mexican muralist and communist Diego Rivera. Interesting that the Rockefellers would pick a member of the Communist Party, a very outspoken member of the Communist Party, to do this painting. Up to that point, in the preceding few years, actually, Rivera had been kicked out of the Communist Party, largely for consorting with people like Rockefellers. He had done a mural for Dwight Morrow, the father-in-law of Charles Lindbergh. He had done a mural for the San Francisco Stock Exchange. He did the Detroit Art Institute for the Ford family. And then he comes and he does this for the Rockefellers. Well, to prove his lefty chops, I truly believe, he had to get himself fired from the job. And he kept on adding more and more insulting stuff to the painting. Things, you know, the Lenin's tomb and marching soldiers in front of the Kremlin and policemen beating up strikers in the streets of New York. And the Rockefellers kept saying, hey, this is great. We love you. You're terrific. And then finally he put in Lenin's head. And then he got fired and he was a very happy man as a result.
We're talking with Daniel Oakrant. His new book is Great Fortune, The Epic of Rockefeller Center. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go on the phones now to Brenda, who's with us from Portland, Oregon.
Hi, I have some great memories as a child of going to Rockefeller Center. My dad worked in the city, and we lived in the suburbs, and my mom would take us in, and we would stop there and meet him for lunch and skate if it was wintertime, watch the Christmas tree be lit, you know, lit up, and I was always taken by the artwork and the majesty of the buildings, and like the other caller said about the underground, was always kind of magical to me. And then as I got older, my father actually was one of the people that was in charge of the remodeling of the underground when they did the whole change and laid the marble and changed everything. And refaced it underground. So it's just, I think it's what made me fall in love with New York City as a child, and still now as an adult, just cannot believe how it's just still magical to me.
Daniel Okrent, that view that she's talking about from Fifth Avenue down that plaza, past the skating rink to look at the RCA building. Was it Gertrude Stein who described it beautifully the first time she saw it?
She said it is the most beautiful thing I have ever seen, which is the way that Gertrude Stein talked, so we'll forgive her for that. Her companion, Alice B. Toklas, said the great thing about the building is not the way that it goes into the sky, but the way that it comes out of the ground. It's a really fabulous image, I think.
Well, Brenda makes a great point, though. This has certainly become one of the most important parts of Midtown Manhattan.
Oh, absolutely. It's the center of Manhattan, and Manhattan the center of New York. New York, really the commercial and communication center of the country and the world. It is the heart of the world, I believe. And one of the interesting things about Rockefeller Center today, you cannot find somebody in New York who doesn't like it. And I can't say that about very many other things in the city that I live in. It's really a terrific place.
Brenda, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Let's talk with Suzanne, and Suzanne's in Nashville, Tennessee.
Hi. I also have a wonderful memory of Rockefeller Center. We came in from Westchester County every year to see the tree light up and the decorations and the angels that decorate that that area, the entranceway to the skating rink. And what I loved most about it was the best view of that area was from an upper story of Saks Fifth Avenue. We used to walk, traipse our way up the escalator into the bridal department. And we'd kind of walk through the bridal department, past all the brides, and clear away the draperies. And there we would see the best view of Rockefeller Center at Christmas time that there was to see.
Did you ever buy a bridal gown on the way up?
Not there, no.
Did you ever go to Radio City Music Hall?
We certainly did. My father's godmother made a point to take us when we were quite young. I think she decided it was one of the things we absolutely had to do. And my dad's aunt, my Aunt Dot, took us to the Rainbow Room, which I believe is part of Rockefeller Center. Is that true?
Absolutely. It's on top of the RCA building.
Yeah.
Yep.
Now, Radio City Music Hall has been visited by 300 million people since it opened.
And Daniel Okrent, we all think of Radio City Music Hall, and we think of the Rockettes and the Art Deco fabulous decorations and the fact that it's a cultural landmark. Opening night, though, was a catastrophe described by the great New York columnist Haywood Bruin as the fall of the House of Ushers.
It was really something. I mean, Roxy Rothafel, who was the entrepreneur, the impresario who had built every extreme movie theater of the era, he was in charge of Radio City Music Hall, and he decided to out-extreme himself. He had an opening night program that included everyone from Martha Graham to the Flying Willendas to the Young Ray Bulger to the Tuskegee Institute Choir. It went on until 2 o'clock in the morning. Walter Lippmann wrote that they had built a pedestal to sustain a peanut. And within 10 days, Roxy wasn't in charge anymore. The Rockettes were put on the stage, and the rest is our wonderful history.
Hmm. Now, we just have about a minute left. What's our legacy? Have people tried to imitate this in other cities, other places?
They tried to imitate it in New York. Even it was John D. Rockefeller III who put up Lincoln Center, and David and Nelson Rockefeller were responsible for the World Trade Center. And every major city has this mixed-use sort of development, but none of them have worked like Rockefeller Center, and it's because they put them at the edge of the city rather than the heart of the city. If you want to go from the east side of Manhattan to the west side, you don't go to Rockefeller Center, you go through it, and it's a living, breathing part of the organic city.
Daniel Okrent, we're going to be hearing from him next, I guess, in his new role. He is the public editor at the New York Times, their equivalent of an ombudsman, and we wish you good luck in that job. It's not going to be easy.
Thanks a lot, Neil.
And one thing we know is if people have complaints about the crossword puzzle segments, you're in Will Shortz's pocket, Daniel. You're not going to get any satisfaction there.
Don't tell anybody.
Daniel Okrent is the author of Great Fortune, The Epic of Rockefeller Center. He's also the new public editor at the New York Times, and he joined us from our bureau in New York. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.